Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Something Offbeat listeners. I'm one of the producers of the show, Lauren Berry, and I want to wish everybody a very happy Halloween. And we wanted to give you a little clip show of some of our favorite Halloween-themed episodes. These stories cover an alleged ghost girlfriend, vampires, and zombies. Links to the full episodes are included in our show notes. Please enjoy these spooky snippets and like and subscribe to our show if you're enjoying them. First up, we've got that ghost girlfriend. What do we mean by that? Well, listen in.
Mike, let's imagine you're packing for a day at the park or the beach. What's going with you?
Well, if I'm in Galveston and the crabs are spawning, probably a wetsuit. Otherwise, some food, some adult beverages, nice big umbrella for my fair skin, the usual. Of course, there are many other things that I would not bring.
This guy's just carrying a dead body around in his cold bag to show off to his friends.
So just to confirm, you're not sprinkling in a mummified corpse among your adult beverages in that bag?
No, I can't say that's on the list, no.
And I think he's using that spiritual girlfriend stuff to try to get away from selling remains and getting put in jail.
I'm Mike Rogers. That is one of our producers, Chris Blake, and this is Something Offbeat.
And Mike, this week we're looking into the story of a man in Peru who was found with remains estimated to be 600 to 800 years old inside a food delivery cooler bag. According to local media, the man told authorities he'd named the remains Juanita and described them as his, quote, spiritual girlfriend. The mummy is believed to be an adult male.
So just to clarify, we're talking about human remains here.
Exactly.
I spoke with Mike Huberty, the founder of American Ghost Walks, to learn more about spiritual encounters and how some people cope with loss. Let me start by asking you about American Ghost Walks.
Sure.
How did it all start? What led you to start it?
Well, I've always been fascinated with real paranormal stories. Growing up, you know, whenever when That's Incredible would feature a werewolf or the haunted Toys R Us, I would get all excited about it. My sister and I would love it. We would listen to these haunted history stories that were on WGN radio out of Chicago when we were kids, and then have Halloween had this guy named Richard Crow on. He basically started haunted history tourism as it is today. So we didn't have one, like we didn't have many ghost tours in Wisconsin. My sister started one in Milwaukee in 2008. I started in Madison 2010. And then I found out there's a whole bunch of cities that don't have these stories, Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, being just a couple of them. So then started writing stories in different towns. And then things just kind of grew from there.
But back to Peru.
These guys are drinking at the park. It's three guys drinking at the park. And then this delivery man is keeping a mummy in his cold bag, like where you keep the Cokes. He's keeping a mummy. And what I think is interesting is that the first thing he says is like, oh, I wasn't trying to sell it.
So you think he knows he was in trouble?
Because he knows that this is not the 1800s or earlier, because people used to have mummy parties. In the 1800s, they've had of unwrappings. After Napoleon had conquered Egypt or whatever, he was bringing back, you know, mummies to Europe, and they were treating them like, I don't know, like you treat a skeleton from the Halloween store during, you know, haunted house season. So it wasn't really until the mid to late 20th century where people were like, hey, we starting to have respect for these, I mean, corpses of humans from the past.
You sound skeptical.
That it was his spiritual girlfriend?
Yeah.
Well, okay, but it wouldn't be the first time that somebody had felt this way about a corpse.
Next, we're going to talk to a relative of Bram Stoker, the author of the iconic book Dracula, about vampires.
it was local superstitions in Poland to stop this body from coming out of the grave. If she was to lift herself out, she would have decapitated herself. And the padlock keeping her, probably there was at the time some wood or something attached to the padlock, it was just stopping her from getting out of the grave.
That's Dacre Stoker. You may recognize that last name if you're a fan of Dracula, the classic novel written by his great-great-uncle, Bram Stoker. But today, Dacre is an expert on both his uncle and, frankly, all things vampire. He's the co-editor of the Lost Journal of Bram Stoker, The Dublin Years, as well as some fictional works in the Dracula universe. This is Something Offbeats, a podcast where we dig deep into some eye-popping news stories. I'm your host, Mike Rogers. For this Halloween episode, Dacre Stoker will help us peek into the coffin for a better look at vampires. Let's talk about that last name, Stoker. Now, that's familiar to a lot of people. Tell me about your family history.
My connection to Bram Stoker, author of Dracula, is that Bram was one of seven children, and I am the great-grandnephew of Bram. I'm the great-grandson of his youngest brother, George, which is interesting, though. Of the seven kids, only three had offspring, and only two have branches of the family still alive. So you would think, you know, pretty prolific back in the day, but not so. So, you know, I've become sort of the one in the family supporting the legacy of Bram. He does have two great-grandsons still alive, but they leave it up to me to help spread the word.
Bram Stoker published Dracula back in 1897, and ever since, it has served as the basis for an entire genre, from silent films all the way to TV series like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and movies like Twilight.
Why did he want to write about them? What fascinated him about them?
It's an interesting question. That's one of the dilemmas, because, you know, I've been looking to answer that question by pulling different pieces of this puzzle for the last 12 years. This is what I figured, Mike. It's about half of it's organic. He was brought up in Ireland that has all kinds of cautionary tales involving changelings, pukas, banshees, fairies, all different versions of blood-sucking creatures that we would call vampires. So he absorbed that as a young boy, as a sickly young boy who I believe was bloodlet himself. So he came by some of that honestly. But he was also really a diligent researcher. So he figured out that at the Middle Ages, that actually the vampire myth scared hundreds of thousands of people in many different countries around the world. We, even in America, had our own vampire scare that he had a newspaper clipping of from New England in 1896. So what he did was he took these sort of existing issues that were out there that scared people and figured out what was really going on in different books in the London Library with scholars and doctors considering that vampirism was real, and blended it together in this novel, Dracula. But the big thing is, other than the other books at the time of vampirism, he made his seem very real.
A little while ago, when the HBO show The Last of Us came out, we reached out to an expert about a possible zombie apocalypse.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, what do you think, Lauren? Do you want to do an episode on this zombie ant fungus?
I do, and I've actually wanted to do an episode about this since before I watched the show. My managing editor assigned me to write an article about it, and I thought it couldn't be real. And then, you know, I started researching it for her, and I found multiple articles about this zombie ant fungus, including a 2011 paper and one from 2020 in the Nature Journal. It can take over the bodies of ants, and even after they've died, the fungus can make them climb and have convulsions like a classic movie zombie.
And this is the same one they wrote into The Last of Us, the video game, which is now the hit TV show adaptation on HBO. It's really pretty creepy stuff. So we wanted to learn more about this, so we reached out to Cameron Carlson at the Zombie Research Society, Yes, that's actually a thing.
Yes, and it's been around for about 16 years now. And yeah, they got us connected with Dr. Cameron Carlson of the U.S. Navy. He is a survival expert at the Society.
That's always something handy to have around. How did you get into this, though? How did this all start for you?
So it really started when I was actually in graduate school working on my master's degree. What I wanted to do was I wanted to take the worst case scenario and I wanted to put it in to play because nobody was really concerned about responding to a disaster. So I said, what's the worst case scenario? Zombies. Zombies are the worst case scenario.
Now, soon he met some others who were working to create the group he now leads with Luke Boyd.
This is kind of a fun topic, especially, you know, with the show The Last of Us, which I assume you're watching.
Oh, religiously. And I'm a huge fan of the game Last of Us. So it's been really, really fun to see how the game translates into the show. And so far, they're bang on.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this nasty fungus. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Ophiocordyceps unilateralis?
Yep, that's right.
Wow. First try.
I know. I mean, that's pretty good.
How does this fungus work here?
Okay, so now, obviously, I'm not a mycologist by any means, but so look at it this way. Most funguses, or in some cases, some funguses are parasitic, right? You need a host, and you need the parasite to actually infect the host. And what it's basically done is in the rainforest of Thailand, you know, certain other rainforests, you think about what insects are in the rainforest. Well, 70% of it are ants. Like 70% of the insects are ants. And the fungus basically sits approximately about 25 centimeters off the forest floor. And it basically will protrude from, I'll get into it in a second, but it'll protrude from an already infected ant after days or weeks. And then basically release its spores onto the ants.
When I was researching for this article, I, of course, had to look up photos. And right there in Getty Images, you can see these ants with what looks like mushrooms, like, growing out of their heads. Did you see those, Mike? Do you have any thoughts?
I did. Yeah, it's the stuff of nightmares. Frankly, they were horrifying. Although, I have to tell you, no less horrifying than the special effects in the show. All those infected people with, I mean, you're right, mushroom-looking things growing out of their face.
Now, the ants are a very specific type of ant. They're basically a carpenter ant called Camphanotus leonardi. And they basically live really high up in the canopies of these rainforests. But when their leaves don't bridge the gap between, let's say, you know, what you consider an ant highway in the canopy, they actually have to come down from their canopy, down the trees, onto the forest floor, and then up the other side. And that's where cordyceps likes to sit, approximately 25 centimeters where the ants are crossing. So basically what happens is those spores are released from the cordyceps fungus. And it's interesting because studies have shown that it actually doesn't take over the ant's brain. It actually takes over the ant's muscle structures and forces it to do what it wants that way. So it is forcing it to do something that it doesn't normally do. And then it forces it basically to climb to the highest point on the leaf. And in many cases, 99% of the cases, you'll see the leaf that the ant is sitting on, the ant has now bitten into the vein, the main vein of the leaf, and basically will die there. And so after a few days and a week, the fungus will continue to propagate itself inside. Then the ant will die. And then the fungus will then basically break through the ant's exoskeleton and begin dropping spores, and the life cycle perpetuates itself.
So believe it or not, that's not the only time we've talked about zombies on this show. We also had our friend Zach Clark on the show, who is a podcaster extraordinaire for Odyssey, based in Detroit, Michigan. You'll understand from this clip why we had him on to talk about zombies in his city specifically.
Mike, you and I live in North Texas. You know what that makes us?
Very sweaty for most of the year.
Well, yes, but it also means we're among the most prepared people in the country for the zombie apocalypse.
That's good to know. Please explain.
Well, in a ranking of the 200 largest U.S. cities, Dallas came in 17th and Fort Worth was 28th when it comes to the safest places to be. The quote study by the website Lawn Love used factors like vulnerability, hideouts, supplies, protection, and mobility to come up with its rankings.
17th out of 200 right here in Dallas. Brother, if that doesn't make the Chamber of Commerce brochure, nothing will.
How else are you going to attract people to move here from across the country? Another city in Texas, Houston, ranked number one on the list. Miramar, Florida was number 200. The worst prepared bigger city that you think of would have been Detroit at 194.
Is there a shortage of grocery stores, hardware stores there?
Yeah, Detroit is in what you would call a food desert, where there are very few grocery stores. And, you know, for many years, there were no large national chains or regional chains in this city either. That's starting to change a little bit. But no, Detroit has very few grocery stores. The mobility one was interesting because Detroit's notoriously terrible for public transportation, which means more people have cars here than they should. Now, in Detroit, it's a little different when you look at the socioeconomic standing. But again, no public transportation means that more people are driving. So I would think you might be able to find a car more likely here than you would anywhere else.
You know, I drove through Detroit once in a Volvo and I got a lot of dirty looks.
I bet you did.
You also came in 162, number 162 out of 200 in protection. Now, this is like guns and gun stores. We did real well, amazingly enough, down here in Texas in that category. You guys, not so much.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't surprised to see the Houstons and the Dallases and the Austins and the San Antonios near the top of that list. But, you know, people talk often that there's a very harsh stereotype about Detroit and gun violence. So, I mean, if we're going to work off that stereotype, this would be fine. And maybe that lets you know that that stereotype isn't exactly fair.
Thank you so much for listening to this special Halloween-themed episode of Something Offbeat. You can subscribe to the show on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.